Pull up a chair. I want to tell you about an airplane that everybody said would kill you. And then I want to tell you about the one example of that airplane that refused to die, refused to quit, and flew more combat missions than any other American aircraft of the Second World War. And she is sitting right now, in pieces, under the careful hands of people who love her. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar, where we don't just talk about airplanes, we sit with them. Today we're talking about flak bait. Now, before I get going, let me tell you who keeps the coffee hot around here. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friends, if there was ever an airplane that earned its coin, it's the one we're talking about today. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back. The airplane is the Martin B-26 Marauder, and I need you to understand something about how this airplane arrived in the world, because it's the whole heart of the story. Back in the late 1930s, the Army put out a requirement for a fast medium bomber. Fast, that was the word that mattered. A company down in Baltimore, the Glenn L. Martin Company, handed the job to a young engineer named Peyton Magruder, and Magruder gave the Army exactly what they asked for. He gave them speed. He built a fuselage like an artillery shell, smooth, round, beautiful, and to make it go fast, he put a small wing on it, a short wing. Not a lot of area out there to hold you up. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Army was so impressed with the design on paper that they did something almost unheard of. They ordered the airplane straight off the drawing board. No prototype, no slow, careful shakedown. 1,100 of them ordered before anybody had ever flown one. And when the young pilots finally got their hands on it, they found out what that little wing cost them. The Marauder had to be flown fast. Flown by the numbers. Every number. She came down final approach carrying a lot more speed than the airplanes those young men had trained on. And if you let her get slow, if you got sloppy, if you lost an engine on takeoff and didn't do everything exactly right, exactly now, that beautiful shell of a fuselage would roll over and take you into the ground. They trained a lot of those crews down at MacDill Field, near Tampa, and the airplanes went into the bay so often that the crews came up with a grim little rhyme, one a day in Tampa Bay. They called her the Widowmaker. They called her the Baltimore Whore, because she had no visible means of support. Pilots joked about it the way you joke about the thing that scares you. Congress got involved. There was serious talk of canceling the whole program and melting the airplanes down. And into that reputation, in the spring of 1943, rolls a brand new B-26 off the Martin line, serial number ending in 45357. She gets assigned to the 449th Bomb Squadron of the 322nd Bomb Group. Now, there's a tradition in this business, you name your airplane. And there was a crew chief named James Farrell, and Farrell had a little dog back home, a scrappy little thing, and the family nickname for that dog was Flak Bait. So that's what Farrell painted on the nose, Flak Bait. It was a joke. It was tempting fate. It was a kid daring the sky to do its worst. The sky took him up on it. Let me put you in that airplane. It's 1943, and then 44 over occupied Europe. You're flying a medium bomber, which means you're not up high where the heavy bombers live. You are down in the middle altitudes, right in the meat of the German anti-aircraft fire. They called it Flak, short for a very long German word for anti-aircraft cannon. And down where the Marauders flew, the Flak was thick enough to walk on. Picture the inside of that fuselage. It is loud. Two big Pratt and Whitney radial engines, 18 cylinders each, hammering away on either side of you, and the whole airframe is buzzing with it, a vibration that gets into your teeth and stays there for hours after you land. It is cold. It smells like oil and hot metal and rubber, and the sweat of six frightened young men. Your oxygen mask is clammy against your face, and out the windows, black puffs are blooming all around you, and each one of those puffs is a shell that just went off, throwing red-hot steel in every direction. And Flak Bait flew into that again and again and again. She came home shot up so many times the crews lost count. More than 1,000 holes in her skin over her career. She lost her hydraulics. She came home on one engine. Her electrical system got shot out. Her propellers took hits. One time she came back with a hole in the tail you could nearly climb through. The ground crews would patch her up overnight, slap a new piece of aluminum over the wound, and send her back out. And she kept coming home. That was the thing about her. Every other airplane around her seemed to be going down, and Flak Bait kept bringing her boys back to England. She flew on D-Day, June 6, 1944. She flew twice that day, over the beaches, hitting the German positions behind Normandy, while the boys came ashore below. By the time the war in Europe ended, Flak Bait had flown 207 combat missions. 207. That was more than any other American bomber in the European theater, more than any of the famous heavy bombers. This unlucky airplane, this Widowmaker, this airplane the whole country wanted to scrap, turned out to be the luckiest, toughest airplane in the whole United States Army Air Forces. Now here's where the story could have ended, and almost did. When a war ends, airplanes become junk, overnight. The most valuable machine in the world on Tuesday is scrap aluminum on Wednesday. All across Europe and the Pacific, they were bulldozing warplanes into pits and burning them, or melting them down for pots and pans. Thousands and thousands of them, airplanes that men had bled and died in, gone, because nobody had any use for them anymore, and the storage cost money. But somebody in the army looked at Flakbait's record and thought, no, not this one, this one means something. So they saved her, they cut her into sections so she'd fit, and they shipped the nose, at least, and eventually the whole airplane, back home to the United States. And they handed her to the Smithsonian Institution. And that, friends, is where this story turns into something you and I care about in our bones. Because a warbird saved is not the same thing as a warbird flying, or even a warbird whole. For decades, Flakbait sat. The nose section was put on display, right there in Washington, and generations of kids walked past that battered green nose with the little painted bombs on it, 200 and some little bombs, one for every mission, and most of them had no idea what they were looking at. And the rest of her, the wings, the tail, the guts of her, sat in storage, boxed up, waiting, slowly, quietly, going to pieces in the dark. Now, here's where it gets interesting, and this is the part I really want you to hear. A few years back, the National Air and Space Museum made a decision. They were going to bring Flakbait back, not restore her to fly. And I know some of you just groaned, because you and I would give a year of our lives to hear those two Pratt and Whitneys light off and see her in the pattern. I feel it too, but listen to their thinking, because it changed how I look at this whole business. They decided this airplane's wounds are the whole point. All those patches, all those repairs the ground crews made in the dark with the flak still ringing in their ears. The mismatched paint, the places where the aluminum was beaten back into shape by a 19-year-old kid who just wanted his airplane to fly one more day. If you strip all that off and make her shiny and new, you have erased the very thing that makes her Flakbait. You'd have a pretty B-26, you would not have her. So the restoration became something more like archaeology. Or maybe surgery is the better word. The conservators, and there's a woman named Lauren Horlick, and a whole team of specialists on this. They are not trying to make her look new, they are trying to make her stable. To stop the clock, to conserve every single original piece, every patch, every scar, every fingerprint of the men who kept her alive. Pull up a chair and think about the patience this takes. They go over her inch by inch, they find dirt in the seams, and before they clean it out, they stop and ask, is this dirt from 1944? Is this English mud? Is this part of the story? They found original grease still in the mechanisms, they found pencil marks. They found the fingerprints of the workers at the Martin plant in Baltimore, pressed into the sealant 80 years ago, still there. And they photograph it, and they document it, and they think long and hard before they touch it. They found the crew's own handwriting inside her. Little notes, little bits of graffiti in the places only a mechanic would ever look. That is a message from a young man in 1944 to us right now, and these folks understand that. So they save it. They're cleaning 8 decades of grime with cotton swabs and tiny tools. The kind a dentist would recognize. They're stabilizing corrosion so it stops spreading without grinding away the good metal around it. They are reuniting that famous nose with the rest of her body, so that for the first time since the 1940s, Flakbait is one whole airplane again, and when they hang the different sections, they get them to line up just right so she looks like she's flying. It is slow. It is painstaking. It has taken years, and it's the kind of work where a good day might mean you conserved one small panel. But every one of those days, somebody is keeping faith with the men who flew her. And that right there is the thing I want you to take home from today. We talk a lot on this show about the warbirds that fly, the ones you hear at Oshkosh with the crowd going quiet and every head turning up. And I love those airplanes. I will love them until the day I fold up my wings for good. But there is another kind of keeper of the flame, and they don't wear a flight suit. They wear cotton gloves and they lean over a workbench with a magnifying visor and a swab, and they are saving something you cannot buy and cannot rebuild once it's gone. The real, actual physical truth of what happened, the genuine article. Touched by the very hands that were there, because someday, and I hate to say it, the last man who flew a B-26 is going to be gone. That generation is nearly gone now, and when they are, all we will have left is the airplanes and the records and Flakbait whole again. Scars and all is going to stand in that museum and tell the truth about what those young men did. She'll do it long after you and I are gone too. 207 missions, 1,000 holes. A dog's name painted on the nose by a kid daring the sky to do its worst. And it couldn't if you want to see where she stands in the work. The National Air and Space Museum has put out a lot on the conservation. And it's worth your time. My thanks to the museum's own conservators and historians for the details, and to the record keepers of the 322nd Bomb Group who kept the story of the Widowmaker that wouldn't die. You can always find more from us over at RadioHanger.com. Next time you walk past a battered old airplane in a museum, one that isn't shiny, one that looks used up, you stop, you look at the patches, and you think about the hands that put them there. This is Tail Dragger. Keep her right side up, and I'll see you back in the hangar.